Hello, Gallatin Valley. This is Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman 95.9 FM. I'm your host, Dr. Nurse Nancy. Our producer is Robin Fly. As most listeners will know, on March 16th, 8 people were killed at 3 separate massage spas in Atlanta. Most of the victims were female, most were Asian. The shooter was a white man. This mass shooting follows a wave of attacks targeting Asian Americans coinciding with the spread of COVID-19 across the country. The names of the Asian victims, 2 of whom were Chinese women and 4 of whom were Korean women, are Xiaojie Tan, Diaoyo Fong, Hyunchan Grant, Soonchan Park, Soon-Cha Kim, and Yane Yu. In the wake of the murders, protests have been organized across the country to call for an end to hate crimes against Asians. Here at Montana State University, a new group, Asia, has come together to combat anti-Asian sentiment. Suddenly, we are hearing much more in the media about anti-Asian violence than ever before. Joining us by Zoom from New York City today, however, are 2 guests who have been documenting aspects of the experiences of Asians in the U.S. for decades. Reiko Tahara came to the U.S. from Japan in 1991. She is an independent documentary filmmaker whose films have been exhibited at festivals and art venues around the world. Since 2010, she has taught at New York University and at Hunter College in the Master of Fine Arts Integrated Media Arts program. Last semester, she taught a course at NYU called Asian Culture, which she describes as a combination anthropology cinema class. Reiko told me in an email that she doesn't consider herself to be what she calls an active activist for Asian American causes, but having seen many of her films, I would argue that her work constitutes cultural activism, intended or not, because they are about her experiences or the experiences of people she loves or feels connected to. Betty Yu is a multimedia artist. The child of Chinese immigrant parents, Betty has a long background in cultural organizing and activism. She is involved with the Chinatown Art Brigade, which is working to challenge the narrative of increased policing and citizen vigilante police patrols. Her projects have also addressed the issue of gentrification, as well as COVID and anti-Asian violence over the past year. Her work has been exhibited across the country. Betty teaches and has been an artist in residence at numerous institutions, including the International Studio and Curatorial Program and Skidmore College's Documentary Studies Program. So, welcome to both of you, and let's start by discussing the response to the murders. Betty, you emailed that you teach a class on socially engaged art at Pratt, and that your class had a lengthy discussion about the issue. What was that like?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you for having me. It was a difficult discussion. And I think it was like maybe there was a day in between to prepare. And I definitely knew it's like our instinct as educators, right? You even if there were no Asian or Asian women in class, I definitely would have made space to talk about this kind of like white violence and white supremacy, which is undergirds all of this. But I have to say, personally, I was feeling very raw, very emotional, and obviously, you know, during this last summer of the sort of racial justice uprisings and reckoning, we've been all thinking a lot about this, right? And the various ways that our communities of color are pit against each other, you know. So I think a lot about that too, and even within the Asian community, there's often a lot of conflict, right? So there was immediately, you know, conversations around criminalizing sex work or massage work or denigrating it or not justifying the killings, but just in a way like, oh, well, almost like, well, you know, they shouldn't have been working there. They shouldn't have been there, you know, kind of thing. And that was very, very disturbing to many of us who believe that sex work should be legalized.
Me too.
And we believe that no matter what, these folks are full 100% human beings, and that should be are respected, whatever work they're in. And so when there was that coming out a little bit from older Asians, that was very upsetting. But what was comforting was there was a Red Canary Song, which is a group of fighting for the rights of sex workers in Flushing. It started out in Flushing, Queens, when there was a woman that was killed. And now is New York City wide did a call. It was a memorial for the victims, and it was really raw and very emotional. And that was very comforting because I felt really isolated and alone and fearful. And I just share that with the students. And I, you know, said that, you know, there are quite a number of Asian women here, and not to put the onus just on women, on the Asian women, or the burden on them to speak, but to open up the space. There was a lot of silence, but you could tell there was a lot of raw emotion. And I'm trying to remember, I think, you know, maybe one person who was not, which was fine, which was not an Asian woman, who just reiterated how disgusting this act was. And also commented that, you know, he was arrested without being killed, right? The white supremacist. And had that been a person of color, had that been someone else who did this crime, I don't know if that would have happened. Well, we had a moment of silence, and you know, I could see some tears in people's eyes. And on Zoom, it's really hard because I've never met any of these students in person before.
Oh, right.
So it's really, really tough. But I think that I think there was a sense of solidarity there. And it certainly made me feel better to be able to open up that space and talk about it. And because all of the whole entire class is about socially engaged art making. And so I was relating it back to the work we've seen last year, even in response to the increased Asian violence, anti-Asian violence, and of course, racial justice uprisings in the wake of George Floyd's killing and Breonna Taylor's killing. So that was a really good opportunity, very visceral and raw to connect the dots. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you know, they're 20 years old, 19 years old. So, you know,
right.
There's a lot there. So,
yeah. Absolutely. And Reiko, what kinds of conversations have you been having around this with friends or family members or even online in terms of organizing?
Sure. I this semester I'm teaching a course called Third Cinema at the Hunter College, as well as at DCTV, which is the Downtown Community Television Center. So I have older students. One is MFA program, so they are like graduate students, and DCTV is like a bunch of grown-up, you know, independent filmmakers coming to take the class from the community. So yeah, so like, you know, when I had those classes, we are studying about the Latin American revolutionary cinema and, you know, and how this resistance cinema or like decolonial cinema, you know, went around the world afterward, you know, since the 60s and 70s. So, but we are also like, you know, trying to learn how important it is to recognize the indigenous community before we learn what happened in Cuba, what happened in Brazil, you know, that kind of thing. So, so we are kind of like, as a class, we are kind of practicing how to pay attention to people who are residing before these revolutionary, you know, things were happening. So I was trying to like, you know, think about how I can set the class with intentions and stuff. And then this, you know, Atlanta thing happened. So I was very vulnerable, actually. And, you know, I was kind of personally, I was very surprised that I didn't really pay attention to this incident until I hear the word sex addict. And I was like, what? And, you know, because before that, I was like hearing, you know, salon. So I thought it's like a nail salon or something. I didn't really dig in. But after I hear this word sex addict, it's like, what? And I researched and I learned about, you know, those victims. And immediately I just, it just hit it. And I became very vulnerable, like very emotional. Because, and especially because those, you know, working mothers from Asia are, you know, working mothers, and I'm also a working mother, so I'm like really connected with them, you know, age-wise too. And I try to look into their past, you know, like their reality, and you know, and I remember some of the films from decades ago dealing with, you know, sex workers in Asia, or like how this, how Asian, a lot of Asian women from different countries and ended up working as a sex workers or sex related work or massages, you know, because, you know, not all of them, you know, perform or like offer extension, like, you know, mm-hmm. the special extra work mm-hmm. as sex work. So I was, you know, really intrigued, like, taken by it. And then I talked to my daughter, who's 23 years old, and to see how she's doing. So I was talking to my family members as well. But when I became, I'm sorry, going back and forth, but, you know, like when I became vulnerable and in class, I could see, even as Betty said, even on Zoom, how people were also feeling, and they, you know, and some of them are in tears, and we could really, you know, spend time together to imagining what the lives has been for those victims. And then right now, like, we are implementing this, like, a common whiteboard to, you know, to see what is the facts that we are, you know, we know about those victims, mm-hmm. and also, like, what the images of the Asian woman that has been, you know, thriving in the United States, uh-huh. and how, as a media maker, how can we use, like, our imagination to connect the dots and then produce new kind of image for Asian women. So it's been kind of very interesting conversation that I'm
having. It's fascinating for me to hear about it. And you mentioned films. You actually sent us a link to a film that we watched called The Women Outside, Korean Women and the U.S. Military, which was very eye-opening for me. I'm wondering if either of you could talk maybe a little about the film, but also about why legalizing sex work is part of what's important in addressing more equitable life, better quality of life for everyone, but including in particular for Asian women, perhaps.
Sorry, I was muted. Rika, you probably know Hae Jung Park. I know Lori does. But I actually worked with Hae Jung for many years, and she's a friend. So that's a very powerful film. I haven't actually seen it in the last couple of years. I mean, it's been a while since I saw it, because I think it was made in the late 90s, maybe. Anyway, I would like to, for me personally, and what was very powerful about that film is that it's coming from people's own firsthand testimonies, right? Because it really humanizes the issue, right? As opposed to some voice of God, right, in the documentary world, who is imposing a certain narrative and how we should feel and this kind of thing. And a lot of my own work is around that, right? Speaking from the heart and speaking from our own truth to power. And I just, you know, and you probably know this, but, you know, the background of why Asian women are often hypersexualized and exotified and, only seen in this one dimension and in a sexual manner, it goes way back, right? When you had the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, and even before then, starting, you know, when the first Filipinos were coming to work in the sugar canes, it goes way back even to 1840s and 1850s. But when you had 1870s and 1880s, a lot of people like my great-grandfather who came to work on the railroads mm-hmm. In Nevada, who came and their Chinatowns were literally burned down. Mm. And so when the 1882 Exclusion Act passed, they knew the one way to try to literally kill off Chinese in America was to prevent the woman from coming. And so the laws that changed, right, at that time was really explicitly all Asian women, Chinese women are prostitutes. And they're going to ban prostitution, right? They suddenly labeled every single Chinese woman a prostitute. And you had to, like, sign an affidavit and say that you never were involved. I mean, it was a whole thing. So the women that were there already were already considered prostitutes, right? Mm-hmm. And then for 60 years, Asian women, Chinese women couldn't really come to work from China, as we know, because it wasn't repealed until much later. And I just, you know, wanted to point out the roots of that. And also, as we know, I think that a lot of also Korean American organizations have put out solidarity statements because of, you know, four of the women were Korean Americans. And we know the history of the military, right? Militarization in the Philippines and Korea and in so many places, Vietnam, of course, and how that plays out, right? And so I just, you know, it's I just want to say that I think that there's that piece of it. The piece that I think even in our own community, again, this criminalization or demonization of the work. I just feel like, in our work, in certainly my work, I'm, you know, try to address that, because I think that we have to challenge the mainstream, even Asian American narrative, that not only that we're passive and docile and don't speak up, or, you know, or criminalizing one another, but that the solution is also not increased police presence. In Flushing, in a lot of neighborhoods in New York City now, a lot of the Asian vigilantes are coming out of the woodwork again and calling for their own cop patrols. And that is absolutely not the solution. And there are a number of activists and community organizers in New York City and throughout the country who are putting very thoughtful, solid plans and proposals that are alternatives to policing, increasing policing, because we know that that only adds to the anti-Black and anti-Latino sentiment that is very, very present in the East Asian community. It's so present, and we absolutely need to challenge it. So at the core, I think that, you know, there are some solutions out there, but I just wanted to get that in because it's very easy just to talk about. I mean, absolutely, we have to honor these Asian women who lost their lives. And also there was an attack over the weekend in Times Square of a 65-year-old woman that got bashed in the head. She's in critical condition, right? And so all these people, but you know, we have to understand that the root cause of a lot of these incidences, because they are happening by people of color who are perpetrating these acts. So how do we get to the deep root cause of racialized, like, capitalism, and what actually causes this divide and conquer that we see, right? Like model minority myth, right? Mm-hmm. Asians are thought of as a model minority. Why was that created in the 1950s and 60s, right? Mm-hmm. Because of the Black Power and Liberation Movement, and they needed to figure out how to pit Asians against other people of color who were leading liberation fights, right? So there is a movement of left Asian American activists like Yuri Kochiyama, like Grace Lee Boggs that we know of, like the woman who've led this fight. But of course, the media likes to just focus on, you know, the mainstream Asians who want more police and, you know, are anti-Black and all of this. So sorry, I can go on and on. But
no, that's great. That's great. For our listeners, I'll say you are tuned to Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman. Our guests today are Betty Yu and Reiko Tahara. We have been talking about anti-Asian sentiment and violence, and also about cultural organizing. One of the issues that I think you're both familiar with is gentrification. Reiko, I know, so I will just say that here in the Gallatin Valley, where our show is based, we think our housing prices are really high. Compared to New York City, not so much, however. Reiko, I know that you've had some firsthand experience with the effects of gentrification. And Betty, I know some of your work has focused on this, particularly in terms of its impact on China, the integrity and strength of Chinatowns. Reiko, could you talk a little just about your situation and what you've seen in terms of gentrification?
Sure. Can I also mention something that you asked, Betty? You know,
yeah.
Can I reiterate? Okay, great. I think, you know, what Betty said is really important, you know, about the police presence, and we have to be watchful for that because, you know, it's really super important. At the same time, I would like to kind of emphasize, you know, the reason, I mean, as Betty said, U.S. military existence throughout Asia since the World War II, really. But even before that, you know, as Betty also mentioned, you know, like the what was it? Like a Spanish-American War in 1898. And, you know, like Cubans call it the War of Independence in Cuba. And in Philippines, they call it American War, because somehow, you know, what happened in Cuba affected Philippines, and the America, I mean, Philippines became the colony of United States afterwards. So it was like a first time U.S. literally like colonized, you know, Asian country, you know, to join the Western force to control Asia. And so ever since then, you know, throughout World War II and the Vietnam War, and, you know, it's like the base is throughout, it's there still. And where the U.S. bases, the sex industry, you know, bloomed. And so even like, you know, in Japan, after the war, Okinawa, Yokosuka, everywhere, like where the U.S. base is, there's, you know, the girls called Pan Pan Girl, you know, pampan girls, meaning pampan is like, you know, it could, mm-hmm. it could come from a different origin, but, you know, pampan can be the sound of, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. you know, sex act. And so it has a different origins. But pampan girls are degraded and looked down upon. And if you see like a Kurosawa and Oz films from the 1950s, or like, you know, early 1950s, during the U.S. censorship, those pampan girls appears in the film. So it is kind of important. And I was also looking into this, I stumbled upon this writing left by this four young noblemen sent from Japan in late 1500s, like, you know, during the samurai era. And so the end of the 1500s, they started sending the embassy, like an emissary to Europe to learn about the European culture and stuff. And, you know, Christianity was coming to Japan. And this one of the four noblemen left this writing about sex slaves that he saw in the boat, like one of the boat. And so the Japanese woman as sex slaves in chains, you know, in the boat existed even in like, you know, 1580s. And so I think it's like a huge long history of Asian women as sex slaves, you know, sent to Europe, to Asia, to many different places. And mm-hmm. it is completely connected to the colonization. So it is really important to look into the history and learn how this image of the hypersexualized, you know, Asian woman come from. And, you know, so I just wanted to insert that.
Oh, yes. Thank you for this. Thank you.
Yeah. And also, yes. Okay. So let's talk about the gentrification. Okay. So my personal experience, I came to Brooklyn in 1991, and I loved the mixture of the people there, and I lived there. But almost 3 years ago, I was gentrified out of Prospect Park, Park Slope area. I could no longer afford it because my rent was $1,600, and then it was jumped to $3,400.
Oh my goodness!
A month.
Oh my goodness.
And I'm like, okay, you know, adios. So I left, and then Apple Store came. So, you know, and what was it? So Apple Store and I kind of like, you know. So I moved to Ocean Hill, Brooklyn, which is historically a Black neighborhood, Black mm-hmm. and Latino neighborhood. And so I, you know, I'm always this way. Like, I'm always like the first way of gentrification in the poor area. So I'm gentrified and I'm a gentrifier.
Fire, right.
Yes, and I have to be always aware of it. And, you know, like I joined the community garden, and community garden in East New York, or, you know, those like deep into Brooklyn, they are often represented by Black women, strong Black women. And, you know, I'm learning so much from them, and I'm just, you know, learning about the gardening, learning about the community. And I'm always trying to sort of maintain the hierarchy there, because there's, you know, new people coming in and want to join the garden, and they, including me, can change the culture. And I don't want to change the culture. So I, you know, it's a daily thing. It's a daily reminder of where I am and what I do and what I do with them. And, you know, and I'm also not so privileged financially. So I, you know, so it is a question of how much I want to embrace my immigrant woman of color status and work with them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. That's a great analysis. And Betty, I know a lot of your work has focused on the issue of gentrification. Can you talk some about that?
Sure. Yeah. So a lot of my personal work has been focused on gentrification as it intersects with like other issues, like, you know, institutional racism and policing and all this. But, you know, again, starting from my own personal story. So I grew up in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, was born and raised there. And in the last 10 years, Sunset Park, the Latinx side where by the water. So just give a visual for folks, all of these waterfront industrial spaces by the waterfront, not just in New York City, but throughout the country, are becoming ultra gentrified really fast. It's accelerated in the last 10 years. And of course, artists and tech workers and innovation makers, they call them innovative tech makers, are usually the ones who are in the first line of gentrification. And it's important to distinguish individual artists, like working poor artists, and then the developers who know exactly, they calculate how to create this division between working class residents who've been in a neighborhood for a long time and pit them against like artists and independent gallerists, right, who have moved in. But really, in my mind, it's a lot of this is state sanctioned economic violence, meaning, mm-hmm. you know, the state is sanctioning all this kind of gentrification all around the city. And then using pitting people against each other, working with the developers to pit people against each other. With that said, the neighborhood that is in Sunset Park, the Latinx part by the waterfront, there's a place called Industry City, which is like a $1 billion venture project between companies in China, developers in China, and financiers in China and here in the US. And so it's become like this innovation artist maker space. And they've expanded, and it's impacting, trickling down to where my parents live, which is in the Chinatown part. And it's getting gentrified so fast, even with COVID. On my block that I grew up on, there's like two or three big new condos going up, even under COVID. Mm. And a lot of the money is coming from China, but it's also domestic. Mm-hmm. So what happens is a lot of the Chinese Americans who are wealthy work with overseas Chinese banks to finance these projects. And a lot of my work has been looking at my family's block and how it's changed and how the prices have gone up, the taxes and everything. And my fear is that my parents, who are garment workers, they work really long hours for very low pay. They're both retired on very fixed income. How are they going to be able to afford to live there and stay there? Because now all the mom and pop places during COVID have been pushed out. And what's right. coming in are the fancy bubble tea shops and the higher end shops that are not for people like my parents. And so I've been documenting that through photography, video, and I'm working on a VR like 360 project as well, documenting this from my parents' perspective and the perspective of longtime residents in Brooklyn's Chinatown. And then I'm also a founding member of Chinatown Art Brigade. And Chinatown Art Brigade has, for the last 5 to 6 years, been working with a grassroots organization in Manhattan's Chinatown called CAV, Organizing Asian Communities. And they have a tenants union, Chinatown Tenants Union. And after 9/11, there has been accelerated gentrification in Lower East Side in Chinatown. And we've been working with tenants to help amplify their stories through projections at night. So we've been projecting their own words and their own images and their own stories of resistance and resilience onto the walls of Chinatown on buildings at night as a way to put the call out for other tenants to join the fight, but also to let there's been 120 galleries that have replaced mom and pop place in Chinatown. Very fast, very rapid, and a lot of developments. And we're not trying to say you're the enemy, but we can say you can take a stance here. You can do the right thing. And that's really kind of like when the rubber hits the road or whatever it's called, where will you stand? Will you stand with the tenants, with us, or will you stand with the developers? And ultimately, I feel like that fork in the road is being drawn in many, many places in New York City. And COVID has accelerated predatory gentrification, because so many businesses are foreclosing, so many small landlords mm-hmm. are foreclosing, and you have the big developers who are buying up blocks and blocks of property at very low rates. And we'll see the fruits of that in the coming, you know, 5, 6, 7, 10 years from now. And so it's very, very, very worrisome when this ban on evictions is lifted, because we should have rent. Mm-hmm. Rent should just mm-hmm. be canceled. In these very vulnerable neighborhoods, we're all super, a lot of the groups I work with are getting ready and trying to gear up for legal services and the services that are needed to help these vulnerable populations, because literally thousands of people will be homeless because they've lost their jobs, you know, and they can't pay rent.
You've been listening to Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman. We've been talking with Reiko Tahara and Betty Yu about cultural organizing in Asian communities. Stay tuned for the second half of the show.